man, can I tell you, in my world, my job is to come up with sermon ideas or sermon titles, and there's been some over the years that I've liked and others where I went, man, I wish I could change that. This particular title, it excites me because I really believe it captures the essence of what Jesus is seeking to do, that he really has at the core of his being, his intention for the world. He wants heaven and earth to authentically touch again, be overlapped, intermeshed, and that will be the completion of all things. And what I like about this title in part is we're borrowing it from a prayer, but in this it reminds us that it's more than just a prayer. It should be something that we're seeking to see translated into the world. So it's not simply something that we simply are waiting to have come about, but in a very real way, it also reminds us in Duval or Monroe or Carnation or whatever, it reminds us as much as we pray for it, we should be presenting it. We should be actualizing it. We should be embodying the stuff of it and showing what Jesus' kingdom looks like in real world spaces. And so that's what this series is really all about. It's giving us a sense as a church over the next several weeks, hey, what are the things that make us unique and distinct in such a way that our community says, wow, there's something different about those people. There is something about the way they do life, respond to problems, have a disposition that it's just like, man, little pieces of heaven are touching the stuff of earth, touching Duval, Carnation, Monroe, Eastside, whatever it might be. That's the heart of this whole series. Now, last week we started with kind of our big emotive why, correct? And we said, the reason we get out of bed, the reason we do ministries, the reason we have staff and set budgets, the reason we're building a building downtown on Main Street is for this one single primary reason. We want to make sure that we are helping people believe that life is better with Jesus. Authentically helping them believe that, own that, take that into their core, and then from that they live that out. See, I really believe that that statement is critical because when you own it, when it is true in your bones, you have a better life. Not that life is always easy or simple, I've said that many times, but your life is better, and in that, you make the lives of other people better as well. Because you're letting Jesus' heart and priorities govern your life. You are acting and reacting to the problems of life in a whole new way, in a way that he informs, and from that, man, that brings flourishing to whatever our environment is. So man, I love that. But today we're going to pivot out of our why and more into our how. How Redemption Church seeks to behave. What it is that we want to own in our disposition and how we play that out in the world that we live in. That's a huge thing, right? Because we have certain behavioral values that we want to own and display and understand more and get better at. And so in our material that we've put out, we've listed 7 things. Then we go, man, we want to fight for these things. We want to protect these things. We want to get better at these things. And I can tell you of all the ones today is the one it's going to get me most excited. Pretty soon, you're not going to be able to keep track. I'm going to be talking so fast today because I'm so excited about it. You're going to be like, wow, this dude's on fire, right? But I'm pumped about this one, and you're going to see why in just a minute. So what I want to do is remind you that we have an app, and in the app, you can follow along with notes. There's a number of blanks to fill in today. We're going to have 3 big ideas today with some subpoints and everything else. But again, I think it's what we need to hear. I'm excited to share it. This is one that really got me fired up. And so right now, I'm going to go ahead and pray, and we're just going to jump right into stuff. All right. Jesus, I thank you. I thank you for you. You know, that's the simplest way I can put it. I thank you for deciding to come into this world as a missionary to rub shoulders with your enemy neighbors, the human race, and to show us a different way, a better way, a more beautiful way. You came to rescue us, and then you came to deploy us as rescued people to go and hopefully see other people come to know you as well. And so I pray that today's conversation will resonate with us. There's going to be times where I think we push. We're going to be uncomfortable. We're going to want to resist certain things. And I pray that you punch through that, and your spirit would give us a conviction of joy in these things that you challenge us with. And so I'm asking you to boldly and beautifully inspire us to greatness in your name today. And so Jesus, we love you. We thank you. We look to you this morning in your good and perfect name. Amen. All right, we're going to start with a pop quiz. You know, I love pop quizzes. The good news about this one, you don't have to raise a hand. You don't have to answer out loud anything. I want you to just think in yourself the answer to this question. According to Jesus, right? So you're thinking Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You're thinking about the Gospels. According to Jesus, how does somebody become, and I'm going to put this in air quotes, a Christian? According to Jesus, how does somebody become a Christian? The reason I put it in air quotes is because that term didn't get used in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It comes up later in the book of Acts, so that was a word that came out of the resurrection and birth of the church and everything else. But when you think about what Jesus did and said and how he interacted with people, just that simple thing. How did somebody become a Christian according to Jesus? Well, I'll tell you some things he did not say. Jesus, for example, never said, accept me into your heart. Never said that. We don't find that term anywhere in the New Testament, in fact. He also never said, pray to receive me. He never said, believe a list of criteria, or receive a formula, or go to church, or read your Bible, or be moral, or vote conservative, or reject wokeism. He didn't say any of those things. You know what he said? Something real simple, so base and basic, it's mind-blowing. It was a real simple concept. He said, follow me. He said that repeatedly. Follow me. Eight letters, three syllables, two words, one bold invitation for those who are willing to step into that. Because at the core of this, and this is what I start getting excited about, at the core of follow me is very simple. You've been doing life your way, thinking your way. You need to change your thinking, which is what the word repentance, all it means is change the way you think. Turn around from what you're doing, go in a different way, and what I've said was the priorities are no longer the priorities, and I'm going to follow you. I'm going to watch how you do life. I'm going to see your action, reaction, responses, proactivity, and I'm going to do that thing. Literally, when we decide, hey, I'm going to follow this guy, this man who is God, what's happening there is we're stepping into a shadow, and we're like, where you put your sandal prints, I want to be lock stock with that. I want to be going the same direction. I want to be covered in the dust of this rabbi who is God, and I'm going to learn from him, and I'm going to engraft all this stuff into my life, and then I'm going to go do what I see in him. That is the invitation to follow him. Now, here's one of the first things I'm going to say that might bug some. When I look at the life of Jesus, I'm relatively convinced that he did not come into the world to start a religion. I really believe that. I don't think his plan, his desire, his heart was like, we're going to have another religion contending against all the other religions. In fact, sometimes I find when religion gets a hold of Jesus, it's also where he can get a little tampered with, contaminated. We dilute his intensity, because when I look at the life of Jesus, I go, actually, I think he was coming to start a revolution. An otherworldly, upside down and backwards revolution. You could almost call it the unrevolution. To all other revolutions. Because he comes in and he starts challenging his followers to think of life different, to move throughout the frames of our world in different sorts of ways, right? Because what he wants to do at the core is to undo the damage and the decay of the sickness of sin. He's going to tackle that one. And he knows that, man, humanity needs it, because humanity is spoiled and hurt and hurting because of this thing we call sin. So in that sense, this project of Jesus is authentically like this sandals on the ground apprenticeship program. I don't think he was trying to start an academy or a Bible college. I really think he was like, man, no, I'm trying to outfit people to show the world a different way of life. And so that's my burden for us as a church. I want us to live in that legacy. I want us to be in that uncomfortable space, because when you read about the life of Jesus and you absorb what he's doing, there's some stuff that's super uncomfortable. And yet that's the space, man, where God unlocks some amazing things. And so if I was to talk about the way Redemption Church behaves, and we have these seven things that we want to attempt to do, this first one is the most important. It's at the top of the list. So when we put together our material, if you take our membership class, the first thing you're going to hear from us is, here's how we try to behave. We want to be seeking to be just like Jesus. Like, that's our core. Like, we're trying to use that as the fundamental grid. Whatever Jesus did, however Jesus acted, whatever he said, whatever deeds he did, we want to do those very things. We want to be like Jesus. We don't want to be like religion. We don't want to be like evangelicalism. We don't even want to be like traditional Christianity in some senses, because there's some parts of traditional Christianity, man, they lost Jesus. They wanted power or control, whatever it was. But we want to be like Jesus. Now, in the last 30 years or so, there's been this well-worn Christian meme, maybe a slogan, so popular that we put it on bumper stickers and bracelets, t-shirts and hats, coffee mugs. There's even a game, a board game, called WWJD. What would Jesus do? Right? But here's the thing I want to help you with on this. Before it was like a brand of Christian capitalism, it was the subtext or subtitle of a book written in 1896 by a guy named Charles Sheldon. And the title of the book was In His Steps, What Would Jesus Do? So this goes way back. And it's a short book. It's just a basic novel. And it's about a pastor who is trying to encourage his congregation to look at life through the eyes of Jesus and respond that way. And so the full statement in the book, as people are going about their daily life, trying to figure out how to live out the challenge of the pastor that he's given to his congregation, they keep asking themselves, what would Jesus do if he were in my place? That's actually the full phrase. What would Jesus do if he were in my place? And honestly, while WWJD at first, I was kind of like, oh man, here's just another Jesus junk store thing. You know, like, I just had this, like, whatever. As I thought about it more, I thought, this is really brilliant. Because that phrase makes you pause, right? Like, if you put that in your head, like, I'm going to ask that question every time you run into a thing, it will dramatically shape the way you do life. It will, right? So, for example, let's say tomorrow you have to go into your workplace, and there's going to be some awkward, difficult conversation you have to have. Either your boss is going to have it with you, you're going to have it with a fellow employee, something of that nature. Before you have that conversation, if you just stopped and said, what would Jesus do if he were in my place to talk to my boss or to talk to this coworker or this person that's underneath me? What would he do if he was doing the talking? That makes you think. Or maybe it's different. Maybe it's just when you can sense in your relationships with people that the salsa level is rising, some frustrations are there, things aren't quite right. And in real time, you sense that somebody's getting ready to start kind of using some words that are not healthy, to be able to stop, just hit the pause button, just punch it and be like, what would Jesus say? How would he react if he were in my place? And then just processing that. Or maybe, you know, if you're going through financial woes or you're concerned about the economy or your job's at risk or whatever, what would Jesus do if he were in my place facing these fears? Or all the social upheaval, the political unrest in our society. Well, what would Jesus say in that? How would Jesus handle those things? When would he speak and when would he not speak? What would he do if he were in my place? See, I think this is awesome because it forces us to stop, right, and reflect, as opposed to storm ahead and react. So it's a brilliant, brilliant statement. But it also requires, quite honestly, that we are students of Jesus, like authentic students. So we're trying to absorb how he navigated things so that it can become true to us, so we navigate those things as well, right? Like, we just go like, okay, I gotta just not assume what he does. I wanna learn what he actually did. And see, for me, as I was thinking about this a lot, especially this week, knowing that this talk was coming, I wrote this down to myself, right? So you're brought into my process. I realized it takes a sincere and sustained desire to incarnate the mission message of Jesus. That was the statement I wrote down. Now, you might be reading that or hearing that, and you're like, that's a word salad. I don't know what half that stuff is talking about. Matt's weird brain saying stuff, right? So let me break it down really fast, sincere. In the Greek New Testament, it's written in Greek, and the word sincere comes up, and it literally means without wax. And it was used of like statues in the marketplace. If a statue was broken, something was chipped off, they would use wax to seal the break and make it look like stone. But if it was a perfect statue with no wax, it was stamped no wax, sincere. Authentic, right? The real deal. So this pursuit has to start with that space of being authentic in that way. Next, it has to be sustained. To really become more like Jesus means we have to make this a habit. It can't just be kind of on again, off again, you know, when it fits, it's a fad. No, it's just got to be, I'm going to keep every day trying to do this again. I might fail 100 times, but I'm going to wake up tomorrow and try it again. Sustained. Beyond this, it has to be desire. Can't be fueled by dogma, because that sometimes makes us negative. Can't be always fueled by duty. I mean, sometimes you need duty to get it done. But it needs to be a desire. I want to be like Jesus. Because you're going to need that desire, especially I need that desire when sometimes it's hard to do the Jesus thing. Because there's many things that Jesus asks us to do that are really, really hard, and you have to desire to be like him in those hard spaces. Next, I said incarnate. Incarnate. See, I say this because I was thinking about it in my own life. I love academics. I love debate. I love the academy and all of that. And too often, we kind of look at Jesus as a thing to be studied, as a doctrine to be built, as a person to be revered. But when it comes to actually living like him, that can be a little bit more difficult. But to incarnate Jesus literally means to flesh him out in my life. To flesh him out in the messy, thin layer of chaos that is the human condition. I had a friend of mine use that term this week. The messy layer of chaos that is where we all live, life. It's figuring out how to live Jesus in that space. And then I called it the mission message. Because Jesus didn't preach all this stuff so we could have Bible studies. He didn't preach all this stuff so we can just memorize things and put them on coffee mugs and stitch them on pillows and have them on bumper stickers and all of that. Like Jesus is like, no, man, this is a playbook I'm giving you. It's a playbook. He gave us a tool, right? If you have a shovel that you have mounted to your wall and it's all shiny and never used, it's a useless shovel. It's not a tool. It's a piece of art, right? And so when Jesus gives us his message, he's like, man, this is, again, boots on the ground, getting dirty, doing stuff, making it happen, making this a reality for the world to be transformed by. That's his heart, right? That's his heart. And so that's what we want to do. And so the question today is then, how do we do it? How do we seek to be like Jesus? How do we prioritize things? Well, again, I'm going to give you three core waypoints, right? Just going to unpack three things, and at the end there'll be a few more things that are rapid fire, but I'm going to start with the most fundamental thing. It starts with this right here, right? How we perceive the world. So it's the first thing kind of in your notes. It's to think like Jesus. We need to really become students of how he thought. Now, some of you may say, wait a minute, you can't know the mind of God and Jesus is God. But Paul says in 1 Corinthians 2, oh, no, you know the mind of Christ. I love that he says that. You know the mind of Christ. If you stop, you read, you think, you pray, you ponder, you meditate on those things, you can know the mind of Christ. And from that, you can embrace and emulate that mind. What it requires, though, is seeing the world with his agenda. Because he has an agenda. Like Jesus, when he hit like the third rock from the sun, had a reason for coming. Right? He's not like Kal-El, who came from Krypton and was like, I just crash landed here, but I got superpowers. I guess I'll make the best of it as Superman. Like, that's not what Jesus did. Like, it was super intentional, right? And so he comes with a purpose. In fact, he says it this way in John chapter 6. He says, I have come down from heaven to do the will of God who sent me, not to do my own thing. Not to do my will, but to do his will. So everything that Jesus did revolves around that priority. So then from that you go, okay, well, if that is the thinking of Jesus to do the will of the Father, maybe we should look at what was the thinking of the Father to send Jesus. And when you do that, it's nailed for you. It's the most popular verse in all the Bible, right? This is how God so loved the world. What's in the mind of God in sending the Son? He's like, I love the world. I'm sending him because I love the world. He gave his one and only Son so that everyone who believes in him will not perish but have everlasting life. God sent his Son into the world not to judge it. Lock that in. He sent his Son into the world not to judge it, but to save the world through him. So here's the Father. Man, I love this thing that I made. It's off the rails, but I love the people of this thing that I made, and I love my son who can solve the problem. I'm sending my son in love, not so he can judge them all down there, but rather he can save them. That's the thinking of the Father and the Son in this whole project right there. And that word saved, I'm going to unpack that for just a second. I want to disrupt us a little bit. In Greek, it's the word sozo. And I would say much of the time when you come across it, it is describing going from death to life, from sin to forgiveness, right? From heaven or from hell to heaven. Like it has that sense of like going from this state to that state, saved. But it's not the only way that it's used. In fact, if anything, we find that this has a lot of bandwidth, and understanding the bandwidth gives us a sense of what it is we're trying to do in this world as well. In fact, in Matthew chapter 9, familiar story. There's this woman. She's been suffering for over a decade. She has this blood flow, which in her culture makes her religiously unclean, unwanted. Nobody wants to touch her. Nobody wants anything to do with her. But she's heard about this rabbi who's doing miracles, and she thinks maybe if I can just get to him and touch the hem of his garment, something can happen. So she's pushing through the crowd. Everybody she touches, she contaminates, right? So now she's bringing like uncleanliness to everybody. They don't even know it, but she's affecting them. But she's just so desperate to get to this man who could change everything. And she says to herself, if I can just touch the hem of his garment, perhaps I will be sozo, healed, cleansed, changed. But for her, it's very physical because of her problem. In Luke chapter 8, there's a demon-possessed man. He's released by the power of Jesus. And everybody says, he's sozo. And there we translate it as restored, made whole. Right? So context drives how we use this word. In John chapter 11, Jesus' friend Lazarus has died. And Jesus is coming to the scene and he tells people, don't worry, he's only asleep. He will sozo. He'll recover. See, what I love about this is that this word saved has so much going on in it. It's sometimes about lost and found, but it's also about bringing healing, restoring hurts, restoring lives, bringing something different to bear on the environment than what it senses and feels, which means our goal is much bigger. Our needs that are required of us are much bigger than just I just give the gospel and I'm doing everything that Jesus wants me to do. No, we're to be healers as much as gospel givers in this whole thing. In fact, this is exactly what Jesus says of himself. There's this time where religion is busy critiquing Jesus, basically because religion and because of Jesus, like they don't seem to get along always super well. And so it says in Mark chapter 2, it says, but when the teachers of the religious law who were Pharisees saw him eating with tax collectors and other sinners, they asked his disciples, why does he eat with such scum? I'll just for a second, just pause there. When I read that, every time I read it, I'm always confronted personally. And I go, is there anybody in society that I look at them kind of like that? Is there anybody that doesn't see the world as I do, agree with my political view, agree with my social view, agree with my moral view, where I look and I go, scum, dirty, awful, atrocious, whatever the thing would be. I'm firmly a Pharisee at that point. I would relate. So I'm confronted just by that mere fact right there. And so they want to know, why is Jesus hanging out with scum? But when Jesus heard this, he told them, healthy people don't need a doctor. Sick people do. I didn't come to deal with those who think they are doing right by God and right by others. He goes, I really came to deal with those who realize they miss marks. They cross lines. They know their life's a mess. He's like, that's who I came for. Now, while there's a bunch of stuff in this that I would love to unpack, I'm going to stick with this idea of thinking like Jesus, right? Because what I love about this is as he's approaching the world with all of their problems, their failures, their mistakes, their sins, their perversions, you name it, as he approaches that, he doesn't roll in as judge saying, yes, they tick me off all the time. I'm hanging out with them because I can't wait to fry them, and that's all I'm looking at right now. I just can't stand this sinful world. No, he's looking at it, and he's like, they're sick. They're hurting. They need a healer. They don't need a judge. They need a doctor. This is what I love about the stuff of Jesus. In fact, for me, it's pretty interesting. In the last few years, I've become this fascinated student of the Eastern Orthodox Church. Not that I want to become Eastern Orthodox, it's not my jam necessarily, but there's some stuff in there that is really fascinating about some of their theology. And one of the things that gripped me, because part of the reason I was curious, is most of us trained in seminary, we're only trained about the Western Church, we're almost never trained about the Eastern Church. It's all about the Catholics and Protestants and our fight back 500 years ago, and it's not as much about the oldest Christian church in the world. The Eastern Church is the oldest church, starts in Acts 15, right? It's old. But it's interesting because in our Western world, when we tend to look at things of sin and God, we kind of treat it very judicial. That's just kind of the way the argument shaped up in the Reformation. And so we kind of looked and we said, well, sin is a violation of law that must be punished. And that was really what anchored itself. And not that that isn't true, and not that the New Testament doesn't kind of orient toward that direction. In some ways, it does. But the Eastern Church looked at it different. They looked at it clinically. And they said, sin is a sickness that needs a healer. Right? It even puts it in the positive a little bit more. We're like, it needs judgment. And they're like, no, it needs a healer. It needs a doctor, which is exactly what Jesus articulates. And I love that because it just reminds me of maybe what our dispositions should be. If we're talking about the thinking part of it, what our thinking should be. When we look at the people of our world, it shouldn't be to judge them or categorize them or vilify them or look down on them. Again, I look and go, that's what the Pharisees did. Scum, untouchables, those people that are wrecking America, whatever our way of articulating it is. Jesus is like, yeah, they have some issues. They need healing. In fact, there's this great scene where Jesus tells a story. He says, there's these two guys that show up to the temple to pray. He says, one is a Pharisee, very well-respected, loves the Bible, very faithful and devout. The other is a tax collector. What is the prayer of the Pharisee? He says, thank you, God, that I'm not like those other people, cheaters, sinners, adulterers. No, I got it figured out. I'm pretty good. Well, the other guy is just beating his chest. He knows he has issues. And Jesus is like, which one goes away right in the sight of God? The one who thinks they have it more figured out or the one who knows they don't? See, what that is thinking like a judge, not like a physician. The Pharisee is thinking like a judge. Not thinking like, this poor tax collector, I should befriend him. Nobody else will. I should reach out to them because nobody else is going to care about this guy. This guy's a traitor. Now, he doesn't do that. He just says, no, I'm better. He's worse. Split. Thank you, God. I'm better. What a great lesson, right? See, to truly seek to act like Jesus here means we must think of people as he did, not as moral problems, not as social threats, not as political foes, but as hurting humans who need a healing God. Like, that has to be our grid, hurting humans that need a healing God. Now, what can aid in this process is the second thing in your notes. It means we need to feel like Jesus. Authentically feel like he felt. Right? And I don't want to overlay too much like, hey, I think I know exactly how Jesus feels, you know, because we can all do that. I think we all tend to even maybe overlay things that are a little bit more our disposition than maybe what's fully revealed. But I'll try to keep this simple and go like, I think there are times where we actually are told his feelings and we can learn from that. And what I find most of the time in these examples is that I find him hurting for a hurtful world. He is hurting for a hurtful world. And I want to be clear, I said hurtful world because what I do think is this world can be hurtful. People can hurt God, people can hurt one another, people hurt themselves. That's the problem of sin, right? Sin is like an infection that becomes decay, that becomes death. That is the problem. But in the face of that problem, I'm trying to look and go, man, how did Jesus handle this? And again, I'm so impressed by the fact that he wasn't disgusted by us and he wasn't vengeful toward us and he wasn't sick and tired of us. Not at all. In fact, there's a scene where he's been healing and preaching and his fame is spreading and the crowds are coming in, and those crowds, you ready? They're sinful, they're hurtful, they're hurting. And when he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were confused and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Isn't that a great way to see it? uncomfortable for sure. But looking at these people, he's like, they're confused. They're helpless. They barely know why they're doing what they're doing and how they're getting there. And from that, he has compassion. Understand, it's always easier to be critical. I get it, right? But I love the fact that this was his heart, because you know what? Here's what we all know. We live in divided times, man. We live in divided times. We are super tribal. You pick the topic, right? Conservative, liberal, left, right, like Biden, Trump, Coke, Pepsi, doesn't matter the thing, right? There's all kinds of stuff, woke, anti-woke, LGBTQ+, anti-LGBTQ+. You pick your topic, there's division. And in the division, there's not a lot of compassion. There's a lot of judgment, right? A lot of critique. It's very easy to demonize one side and idolize the other. It's easy to say, my side's smart, your side's dumb, right? My side hasn't figured out, your side is going to destroy our culture and country as we know it. It's very easy to do that. But Jesus is brilliant because he's always finding the third way, right? He's like, yeah, I'm going to meander through all of this. I mean, this is why they pitch him things like, hey, what do you think about taxes? And he's like, yeah, you guys are dumb. Here's a third way. What do you think about the Romans? Ah, you guys are dumb. Here's a third way. And he was always doing that. It was so genius. And what I love here in his third way is he says, you know what? They're confused. They're helpless. They need compassion more than they need to be called out or sided up or looked down upon, right? Now, does this mean these realities weren't heavy for Jesus? No. The reality of broken, hurting, hurtful humanity was certainly heavy. In fact, there's this scene in Mark chapter 7. There's this man that he's deaf and he's mute, and he wants Jesus to heal him. And just before Jesus heals him, it says Jesus sighed. He sighed. And then he said, be open. And I think that little thing, he sighed, was just that little reminder of like, he's like, oh, I hate the brokenness. And I'm here to heal. In fact, I'd say the only time I really see Jesus get super, super fired up, super hot, really negative, is when he sees religion is poisoning the well of people coming to God. In fact, in Matthew chapter 23, he says, woe to you, teachers of religious law, and you Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut the door of the kingdom of heaven on people's faces. You won't go in yourselves, and you don't let others enter as well. When he says, woe to you, he's not like, whoa, 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 fellas. You know what this really would equate to? What the hell are you doing? That's what it is. Because he even says that later. You guys are sons of hell. You make people twice the sons of hell when you give them this poison to be like this. Well, what was the stuff that was getting in the way? He's like, you're shutting up heaven to souls that need it. And how are they doing this? He says, they crush people with unbearable religious demands and never lift a finger to ease the burden. It's so weird sometimes how religion will come to the non-religious and say, you should live by our religious morals. Right? You know what? Our culture should have our religious convictions as the convictions of the culture. We should be a Christian nation. And I'm like, I would love that. I would love of a nation actually operated off the Sermon on the Mount. It'd be mind-blowing. That'd be so rad, right? Truly Christ-like. That would be amazing. That's not necessarily us. But sometimes there's this pressure like, come on, step up to our line, fulfill what we think is right. And if you don't, you're out. And the problem with that is not only does it fail to draw people in, it actually tends to push them even more away. Because we're making it more about rules and morals than the Jesus who changes everything, who changes hearts and lives and gives new orientation and direction and focus and purpose and heart. In fact, in my own life, I've seen how often it just makes people angry or hurt or bitter, right? That's why I'm always shocked when I look at the stories of Jesus. I'm like, how is the perfect holy God incarnate so attractive to broken, sinful people? Like, why did they want to be there? That's what I want to be, right? I want to be that same space. Think about when Jesus says, come, all who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Because, man, my yoke is easy to bear. My burden, it's light. Like, in the face of religion that had pressures too heavy to bear, you see why this was so attractive. They're like, those guys who judge us and make us feel terrible, or Jesus who's orienting us toward a very different way of doing life. And with that, we want to versus we suck and we need to, right? It's so radically different. And so this was his felt vibe. This was his appeal. This is how he gets stuff done. And so from that, we go into the third thing then. Great, if this is how we get stuff done, then how do we get stuff done? Number three is this: act like Jesus, right? This is what we need to do. We need to think like him, feel like him, and finally, man, we need to figure out how to act like him. And we could go down a zillion roads, but I'm gonna give you some rapid fire ideas this morning, all right? First, act like Jesus by being a different kind of human. I know that sounds weird, but look around at humans. Right, act like Jesus by being a different kind of human. When the Bible says Jesus is the Son of Man, this tips us off to what he is, in part, is a perfect human. The specimen for all other humans to model themselves after. So in that sense, when we're looking at the life of Jesus, we go, man, I want to be a better kind of human because he calls me to be a better human and he models for me what it means to be a better human. In fact, in Matthew 5, just before he goes into all of these new expectations of relationship, which is much of what Matthew 5 is about, like, hey, be made right with people within a week and no less, and make sure you handle your spouse right, and make sure you keep your word, and make sure you love your enemies. All that is relational stuff through chapter 5, also into chapter 6 and chapter 7. Sermon on the Mount is very horizontal. Just before he gets into all that stuff, he says, I want to warn you. Unless your righteousness is better than the righteousness of the teachers of the religious law and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, when he uses that word righteous, it's in the context of the Hebrew Testament, the Jewish population. The Gospels are a Jewish population. They understand that word very, like practically. Like later, when Paul's outside of Jewish life, he's dealing with Greeks, he's dealing with philosophy, he's going to use that word in a very different way to their world. Jesus is dealing with their world. And when they hear that word righteousness, here's another way to say it, and I said it earlier. He's saying, I warn you, unless you're doing right by God and others is better than their variation, you're going to miss it. So the idea of righteousness is actually, hey, I'm doing right by God. I'm doing what God wants me to do and the tone and spirit he wants me to do it. And I'm doing right by others, right? And I'm going to do right by others in the way that Jesus is now outlining it, right? When it comes to relationships and fidelity and keeping your word and turning the other cheek and going the extra mile and not demanding your rights and, you know, loving your enemies and all of that stuff. It's like, this is the doing right by others that is greater than what religion had handed them up to that point. And I love that, again, because it just gives me some orientation of, oh, to act like Jesus means basically, I'm doing the great command. I'm loving God and loving people, and in loving people, it shows that I really love God, because if I can love people as he wants me to, I'm willing to sacrifice for that greater good, showing, God, I love you this much. So that's the first, just doing that. The second is this: act like Jesus by being a portable safe space. You are a mobile safe space. Now, I know some people like safe spaces, but you know what people need? Safe people. They need people that are safe for them. And Jesus gets into this. I just read part of it before. Remember? When he says, come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, I'll give you rest. Why? He goes, let me self-describe. Here's who I am. I'm humble, gentle. You're going to find rest with me. Burdens are different. Challenges are different. I love that. Because that gives me a sense of, oh, that's what I'm supposed to be. I'm supposed to be humble, gentle, restful. A person where another person says, man, you make things feel easier around you. Versus, wow, I feel like I have to measure up to whatever it is you're holding me to and creating burdens for others. See, that's acting like Jesus. In fact, if anything, I've thought a lot about even like the fruit of the Spirit. Like love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, long-suffering, self-control. Just take those things right there. Like, that should be what people associate with us. Wow, you're so kind. You're so long-suffering. You're not easily perturbed. You're not easily angered. You're not quickly frustrated. You're not pushy. Like that stuff is the stuff of Jesus, right? That's what I think is so critical for us to remember, right? So good. Now, it's interesting, going to this next one, this one's a little tougher. Act like Jesus by replacing criticism with compassion. Criticism with compassion. Now, can I tell you, criticism is easy. It's easy. I mean, I find it easy. I can criticize anything. Give me 2 seconds. Compassion, though, right? Compassion in this world, it's tough, especially to have compassion when you have people with sins, with errors, and with mistakes. But here's the thing in Luke chapter 6 I think is really fascinating. Jesus says, students are not greater than their teacher, but the student who is fully trained will become like the teacher. Very famous, popular discipleship passage. Like, oh, okay, we're supposed to be like Jesus. Makes sense. We've been talking about that. It's the theme of the day. What's stunning is where it falls. It falls inside an idea. So it's not just in a vacuum. There's a context. What's the context where this is sandwiched in between? He says, do not judge others, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn others, or it will come back against you. Forgive others, and you will be forgiven. Give, and you will receive. Your gift will return to you in full, pressed down, shaken together, making room for more, running over and poured into your lap. The amount you give will determine the amount you get back. So the amount you are judgy, you'll be judged. The amount you are not forgiving, you won't be forgiven. The amount you are, you will. Like, that's what it is. And then not even breaking stride, then Jesus gave the following illustration. Can one blind person lead another person? No, they're both going to fall into a ditch. Students are not greater than their teacher. But the student who's fully trained will become like the teacher. And why worry? So he goes right in. He doesn't even stop. Doesn't break stride. And why worry about the speck in your friend's eye when you have a log in your own? You know the rest of it. Right? What I love there is he's trying to say, you know what? If you're really going to be a student like the teacher, well, then don't judge, don't condemn, forgive, give, and worry more about your plank than other people's speck. It's a part of being like the master. Besides, here's what we know. We're all human, man. All our poop smells. All of it. We all have stuff hidden, known. We all fall down. We all make mistakes. All the more, don't you want somebody to be compassionate with you, even if they have to confront you compassionately? Right? We all want compassion more than criticism, and so this is a wonderful way to do that. It's a wonderful way to do that. Next, fourth, I got to hustle here. Act like Jesus by developing genuine friendships with outsiders. With outsiders, right? Jesus, this was his trademark. It says, for John the Baptist didn't spend his time eating or drinking wine, and they said, well, that dude's demon-possessed. He's crazy. The Son of Man, on the other hand, feasts and drinks, and you say, well, he's a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. He says, but wisdom is shown right by the lives of those who follow it. See, I love this about Jesus because he actually made friends with actual practicing sinners. He was hanging out with them. To eat with them, they would go like, oh, you affirm them. You support them. You back them. You're chilling with them. No, Jesus, you're supposed to shun them. And instead, he's like, no, I'm hanging out with them. They're actually my friends. Not just charity cases. My legitimate friends. See, the thing that Jesus is always fighting is that religion wants to be judgy. Religion wants to say, no, they're untouchable. No, you shouldn't have anything to do with them. No, don't make any investments there. No, don't hang with those people like they're your buddies. That's a problem. Jesus is like, no, that's not how I roll. And so what did religion do in the face of that? They looked at Jesus and said, you deserve to die. Because that's literally what's being said there. When they say, well, he's a glutton and a drunk, that takes us back to Deuteronomy 21. If parents have a son who is a glutton and a drunk, you take him to the elders, they take him to the city gate, and they stone him to death. Remember this? That's all they're saying of Jesus. He's a bad son. The Son of God is a bad kid. Deserves to die for hanging out with these people. But Jesus says, wait a minute, you're going to see in the end that my way gets the job done in a way that yours never will do. And we all know that, right? We all know, like, do you know of anybody in your life that said, you know what? I didn't come to Jesus until somebody guilted me, judged me, and shamed me. And then I said, you're right. I need Jesus. Thank you for making me feel so terrible about myself. I've never met that. Usually it's friendship and care and investment, and they're like, okay, now I'm considering this Jesus guy. As much as I have some people in my life that are like super, super woke. And if I say the wrong thing and they just unload on me, I'm not like, thank you for that. You've made a great deal of sense. I'm going to go home and ponder that more now. I feel so good about myself for you telling me I'm a racist. Thank you. You know, like, no, when you feel judged, you feel judged. When you feel harshly criticized, so in the same way, Jesus is like, you're going to see my way is wise. Now, not everybody's going to love you. Not everybody's going to be your friend in light of this. Some people are going to resent you and resist you and resist your faith. And when that happens, it's the fifth thing. Act like Jesus by keeping your cool with hurtful people. Just keep your cool, right? In other words, it's an opportunity when people resist you. 1 Peter 2, he says, "For God called you to do good, even if it means suffering, just as Christ suffered for you. He is your example, and you must follow in his steps." So what does that mean? He never sinned, nor did he ever deceive anyone. He did not retaliate when he was insulted, nor threaten revenge when he suffered. I love that. Yes, our world isn't going to like Christians. Yes, our world is going to have some statements and stands and do some stuff. And you know what? We go, sweet, man. No problem. It's another opportunity for me to model Jesus. It's probably the best way to model him. I mean, think about it, even on the cross. Crowds are against him. Religion's against him. His own friends have ditched him. And what's he say? Father, forgive them. They don't even realize what they're doing. Right? I find that actually when people reject us, the more we lean into loving them, probably it's the most compelling way to show that Jesus is the real deal. The real deal. Now, is that going to be easy? No, it's going to hurt sometimes. But even in that, it's the sixth point that can come into play. Act like Jesus by letting the bitterness of life sweeten you. So when you're rejected, oppressed, whatever, what an opportunity, right? Here's a crazy passage in Hebrews 2. Even though Jesus was God's son, he learned obedience from the things he suffered. Is that not weird? Jesus is God, he's God's son, and he learned through suffering. He looked at suffering and says, hey, my tutor, right? I'm going to learn from this thing in my life. And there's all kinds of questions like, how does he learn? But here's what I've realized. Suffering is the great teacher. And I find when we suffer, if you receive it right and it doesn't make you bitter, it can make you sweet. And when you go through suffering things in life, it causes you to have empathy for others who suffer. It causes you to have humility and grace toward those who are in hurting positions as well. And even the book of Hebrews says that. It's like because Jesus suffered, he sympathizes with our weaknesses. Right? That blows my mind. I don't even understand how to put it all together. But that's what it did in him, and that's what it can do in us. That takes us to the final point. Act like Jesus by giving yourself away. Giving yourself away. There's this other scene where Jesus is rolling with the fellas and they're arguing about which one of them is the greatest. So dumb, right? Like you're with God and you're deciding, who's best around here? He's like, you're all crazy. So Jesus called them together. He says, man, listen, the world does it this way. The world lords over people. They use threat, whatever it is. He says, but with you all, it's going to be different. You want to be great, you got to be least. You want to be first, you got to be last. He says in verse 45, for even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others and give his life a ransom for many. He just tells us right there, here's what I modeled. And in that, here's what I'm calling you to do. So that we as a church, man, we want to give back, invest in, make the stuff of Jesus tangible in our space, do great things by having lesser dispositions. That's the best way I know of to seek to be like Jesus. Now in this, I got to close and I'm way long and I know I am and everything else, but I'm just excited about the theme. Forgive me for being excited about the theme. Because here's the thing. I have no interest in religion. Increasingly even, I'm not interested in all the debates that Christians love to have about all sorts of things. I love the Bible. We're going to get into that in a couple of weeks. Love it, especially in its organic, raw, just like almost like untamed form. I go, man, it's so challenging. But I am absolutely infectiously riveted to how to figure out how to be like Jesus. Like, this is my jam, man. Because Jesus is just wild. I was writing notes to myself this like week. Like, he's messy, but he's pure. And he's uncomfortable, but comforting at the same time. And he's questionable, but in that has all the answers for life. I mean, I'm just like, my brain is just on fire with this stuff right now, going, how do we do it? And so I close with questions. Three for you, three for me. First, what would Jesus have you do? What would he have you do? Starting today, what would he have you do? Next, where would Jesus have you go? And then third, with whom would Jesus have you hang? So that you can be a living embodiment and model of his message and his gospel. Now, I'm going to give you mine. And this is going to take just a minute. I hope you give me some grace in this. And then Trent's going to have a really awesome song after this. But have some grace for me. Because you got to figure out what Jesus calls you to do and what uncomfortable thing he wants you to do. And so for me, here's what God gave to me as a gift in my life. He gave me a gay son. right? He's 12 years old. He's in his room. We come in. He breaks down. We realize we're on a journey. And so for 11 years, been on this journey. I've made some mistakes. I've overstepped some bounds, faced some challenges. Gray's faced some challenges, all of that. But this is the son God gave me, right? And so you learn in the context of that, but that put me on a whole other kind of journey, right? And so I can guarantee you, probably of everybody in the room, I bet I've spent more time with people in the LGBTQ plus community than probably anybody else in this room. Maybe there's a few of you that have, but I've spent a lot of time with this community. Just this last year, I've sat across the table from different people saying, tell me your story, right? Having kind of wine and food like Jesus did with people, and hearing their story, hearing their hurts, hearing how many times they had hurts because of the religious community, because they grew up in church and maybe it was mishandled or there were things that were done or said that were just really crushing to the soul. And so for whatever reason that I didn't ask for, God's like, here's the world I'm putting you in, right? And then with this, oh man, this is going to be where you get to be me. You get to be boots on the ground. What would Jesus do if he were in my place, right? Who would he have me go to, spend time with, interact with, call my friends? And so for me, this is not for you, for me, right? This is the thing that Jesus is like, I would have you go and spend time in those spaces. So for example, and this is not going to be for everybody, and some are going to be uncomfortable, and I totally get you. And others are going to be like, hey, that is great, and thank you for that, right? But honestly, like in May, there's going to be an LGBTQ event down at City Hall. And honestly, I had somebody bring that to my attention, and I thought, if Jesus were in town that day, would he just stay home? Jesus asks you to do uncomfortable things. Not everybody's going to love the uncomfortable thing that Jesus asks you to do. And that's okay, as long as you know it's what Jesus wants you to do, what Jesus asks you to model, how Jesus asks you to care. Because the world has religions the world over, but it needs Jesus. It needs Jesus. And so right now, I'm just going to invite Trent to come up, because again, he has this great song, that I think is going to say this better than anything I've said all day. But as he gets ready for this, I just want to go ahead and pray, right? And Jesus, I come before you and I ask that you would give everybody that thing you want them to do. And I'll just be even more bold about it. I'm asking you to give them the uncomfortable thing that they probably don't want to do, that you want them to do. That place you want them to go, and to love people in their space, to look at people as needing healing more than needing judgment. As being a potential brother or sister more than being a social problem. May we have that kind of reckless love that you call us to have. May we lean in versus pull back. May we care more than critique. May we show compassion more than criticism. Help us to incarnate you well. It's in your name we pray.